If Reformation is the outgrowth of revival, what are the marks of that Reformation? Welcome to The Good Word. I'm Alden Thompson, your host and study guide author for our continuing series on revival and Reformation. Our theme for this week is Reformation, the outgrowth of revival. And my conversation partners are again Daryl Bigger and Dave Thomas. I'd like to ask the two of you simply to tell me, how can you tell if it's a true revival? What are the marks of the Reformation that come after that?
I'm interested in hearing your story, Alden, about a great revival in Old Testament times and what that may point us toward in our contemporary lives.
All right, well, let me tell that one. It's one which our study guide uses. It's the story of Jehoshaphat's great reformation and victory in 2 Chronicles 20. It happens that some enemies are coming from the east. In fact, these were old tribal enemies of Judah. And when the word came that there was this huge army was on the way, somebody reported that to Jehoshaphat. Jehoshaphat immediately sent out a word for all the people to come to Jerusalem and pray about it. And they did. And so they prayed with great intensity, and another prophet came and said, guess what? This is going to be a wonderful victory, and you won't even have to raise a finger. What ended up happening was that as they went out to the army to fight, the Lord laid an ambush, but what Joshua and company did was simply to sing their ways to victory. They didn't raise a finger. And those people just totally self-destructed one another. It says that it took them 3 days to carry off all the plunder when they were through. Now, the reason why I think this is particular interesting one is that Jehoshaphat did not remain faithful after that, nor did the people remain. And I'd like to just ask some questions because I'd like for you to respond to me. This is, first of all, is a reformation triggered by an urgent threat. Is that a valid kind of reformation, or do you not have any choice?
That reminds me of our discussions several weeks ago about how our awareness of our need for God often prompts our reaching out to God in tangible ways. So I don't see that as a bad thing. What interests me about this particular story is that the response this triggers, an awareness of the need, triggers the response of prayer. Mm-hmm. Rather than fortifying the city, gathering all the weapons, working out military strategies, instead they turn to God immediately. Mm-hmm. And that, it seems to me, is a good positive mark of the result of a
This is a little bit like the Gideon situation, and he had way too many men. Mm-hmm. You know, cut it back, mm-hmm. cut it back, cut it back. Now, finally, as a small, gruff group, that there's no way he could claim that he did it on his own. Mm-hmm. See,
Daryl, my thoughts ran exactly the same vein as yours, is that this is really a story of a realization of human need in the face of possible destruction. And I agree, I remember those same conversations weeks ago. We talked about how a key component in revival is the loss of human self-confidence.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and I don't mean that in a personal sense, but in mm-hmm. that I can take care of all the business of life.
Mm-hmm.
That God is now sought after in very earnest ways, and that's usually an ingredient in revival. And he has a classic case of it, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yep, mm-hmm. Self-sufficiency is insufficient.
Yeah.
To take care of human needs. And
the problem here, and this happens over and over again, it's one reason why I think revivals are cyclical, is that a revival then rebirths a sense of confidence and gratitude, and then we take the gifts of God as our own and declare independence, and then off we go on our own again until some adversity drives us back to God. So that's the nature of humanity, which is kind of a sad story.
And that's an echo of the John Wesley quote from a few weeks ago, where Wesley said he didn't see how any reform could last very long because it teaches people self-reliance and confidence and hard work, and then they don't need God anymore.
Yeah. So.
Now, there's another curious question that came out of this story as I worked it through, and I'd be interested on your off the top of your head responses to this. This was a revival triggered by a person in authority. could we say it was the pastor that called the people to pray? In this case, it was the king. Which is likely to be more effective in the long run, a top-down revival or a grassroots revival? And then my question was, are there any grassroots revivals recorded in Scripture, Old Testament or New Testament?
Well, I think leadership can play a key role, but I don't think leadership can bring it about. In other words, I think the posture or the demeanor of a leader, if it's perceived to be a genuinely spiritual one, and they have a genuine interest in seeing a revival of godliness among a people, they can have a profound impact. But while a leader's role might be pivotal, it's not. It doesn't produce. I don't think you can produce revivals thereby.
If we were to imagine ourselves being part of the population at that time, Jehoshaphat wasn't creating the need.
Mm-hmm.
He was responding to a broadly sensed mm-hmm. need.
Mm-hmm.
So this leader was listening carefully to his people and then projecting a strategy to deal with that. So I don't see it as him initiating it, but the Jehoshaphat story to me suggests that Jehoshaphat was taking a movement in the country of panic and fear and channeling that in a constructive direction.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Alden, your question prompts a little story from me in Tanzania, where I spent some of my childhood. After Tanzania got its independence, there was a fascination with communism for a while, because communism in theory makes everybody equal, and there was a dual economy in the country, one for Europeans and one for natives. And as part of the communist experiment, they started moving people into villages that were made of different tribal groups. They wanted to demonstrate unity. And they told people that nothing should change, that the traditional dances should still go ahead, etc., etc. And a very observant sociologist came through there and wrote a fascinating little piece in which he observed the difference between the dances in the native tribal villages and the
new corporate ones.
Yeah, the new corporate ones. He said on the outside the dances looked the same, but he said the ones in the that were mandated by government mm-hmm. had no spirit.
Mm.
In the villages they danced for the gods. Mm. In the other one they danced for the tourists and the government.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, there is a I don't know what, there's a spark in a revival that has to be owned by people. It cannot be imposed, although I do agree that a leader can help trigger that. And I think that in the case of Jehoshaphat, he gave people public permission to seek God, which, in other words, it became a national cause, not just a personal one, that you didn't have to fight against the stream or the current in order to do this. It was now commonplace mm-hmm. because even our leaders are urging it.
Mm-hmm. You see, in my experience, I'm a very deeply religious person, and I crave opportunities to meet with fellow believers for singing and praying and so on. That reflects my interest in, you know, even voluntary worship on our campus here. For that reason, I'm glad to be glad to be part of a community where we actually require our students to attend. Because if you don't require, then it is a point of arrogance. I am religious enough. I go to these worships because I am a good boy and I worship God, see. I want to participate in a community that simply says we expect this of one another and we'll do this, and there's no particular credit one way or the other for to do that. And I think for a community to have those common bonds, I think, is important. We really suffer a great deal in our individualistic culture because everything depends upon whether I like it or I don't like it. Mm. And I think there ought to be some common traditions that hold us together where, for the sake of the community, we are willing to do it.
And actually, we put ourselves in charge of the whole process of deciding truth and error, and we don't do very well at it.
Mm. That's right.
And to unite in community reminds me of the story that's told about an aging gentleman who lost his hearing but continued to come to church. Finally, somebody sat down beside him one morning and wrote him a note saying, "Why do you keep coming to church when you can't hear a thing?" And the old gentleman wrote back, "I want people to know whose side I'm on."
Oh, that's good. Want to know what side.
Yeah. Putting ourselves, to giving ourselves an opportunity for God to speak to us and the community of which we are part is much of what revival does, it seems to me. That it places us in a position of advantage where we are open and submissive to God's leading in our life. And that is a major result of revival.
I think revivals do something else, though, and that's they raise the emotional intensity of an experience to the point where people are willing to fight against and even overcome the status quo, change the status quo.
Mm.
That requires some emotional intensity.
Mm-hmm.
The Jehoshaphat story, we have just a couple of minutes here, but I would like to point out what happened because I'm intrigued that with all the examples illustrated, given as illustrations in our study guide, none of them are very pure reformations. For example,
what do you mean by a pure reformation?
Well, let me just give you an example here from 2 Chronicles 20, the summary of Jehoshaphat's life. It says, so Jehoshaphat reigned over Judah. He was 35 years old when he began to reign. He reigned 25 years in Jerusalem. Yet the high places were not removed. The people had not yet set their hearts upon the God of their ancestors. These are the ones who came together to pray, to sing. And even Jehoshaphat himself at the end, he joined up with King Ahaziah of Israel, went on an ill-advised shipbuilding project, and the prophet came out. So here you have this wonderful reformation, but the story itself indicates that it was short-lived and not intense enough.
That doesn't suggest to me that it wasn't a worthy revival, but just that the ascendancy of our human intention to take care of ourselves overwhelmed what could have been a much longer-lasting response.
Would it be safe to say, then, that we ought to drop our expectation level of what should happen in a revival and reformation?
I don't think you need to do that, Alden.
Dropping
expectations is not only difficult, it's often ill-advised.
We'll have a chance to talk more about reformation next time. Our time is up. Our topic next time is the Reformation, the willingness to grow and change. I want to thank both Daryl and Dave for their willingness to help, and for Chad Ofterhaar, our program engineer, and for all of you for listening in. I'm Alden Thompson.
You've been listening to Good Word, a production of the School of Theology at Walla Walla University and KGTS-FM. To order a copy of today's broadcast, you can call 509-527-2194. Thanks for listening, and we'll be here next week at this time with Good Word.